trap. The next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive in this time to wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Journalist, specialist, critical and survivalist. Spitting heaven fire from his lips. Burn the slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the home page, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. You catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. That's in the Black Belt, and catch the live stream at that location. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, it's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, it's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And before you leave that page, do me a favor and just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for Awakening Media is there also. A couple more weeks before we kind of revamp things on Time for Awakening, but you can always catch the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening, plus interesting articles that you can read, share with your friends, and be part of the Time for Awakening experience. Just make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight we're scheduled to have two special guests join us at different portions of the program. Brother Oba Olayinka of the African Marketplace. They'll be doing their event on Saturday, December 22nd, at the Historic Church of the Advocate. Brother Oba is scheduled to join us tonight, and he'll be on sometime during the second portion of the program after the 8 o'clock hour to kind of give us a heads up on what's going on in the third annual Buy Black Marketplace and Pre-Kwanzaa celebration. In the first hour of the program, or a little beyond the first hour, we're going to have historian Mr. Charles White join us. From the historic county of Buckingham, Virginia. So a lot of things going on down there in the news recently. It's a East Coast gas pipeline that's supposed to pass through that historic county of Buckingham down there, where Mr. White will give us a kind of historic background of that county, and also of the Informant newspaper, in which he is editor, been the editor and the chief of the Informant newspaper for over 30 years. That's an historic county down there in Buckingham, and we'll get to the bottom of it and talk about some of the history of Buckingham with our guest, Mr. White. But we'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at African American Museum here at Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Owen.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Kind of a busy weekend. But everything is a little drizzle, but everything went well. I was able to attend the ASCAT fall lecture series that was hosted by the Mid-Atlantic here in Philadelphia mm-hmm. Saturday, all day Saturday.
Dr. J was over there, huh?
Oh, yeah. He came through and had to ask Brother Ron, you know, because Ron is the taskmaster about time. And, you know, Dr. J is when he's, you know, he means to be there on time. But as he said, there's on time and there's African time. And then there's, you know, and I'm adding, and it's Dr. J's time. But he did come through, you know, on time. And he the only thing is he didn't know when Ryan gave him the time whether he was dealing with African time. And, you know, Ron had to work with him because he had to make sure he get it all out. But, you know, Dr. J is a wealth of information and experience. And I think what he does is really communicate to us, share with us his experience based off of his, I think he said he's 82 now, mm-hmm. 82 years of living and being African. And defining what that means in relationship to operationalizing that. And that's what he was communicating to us this time. You know, how the different scholars, how he evolved and how the connection of creating this global African worldview, but global African reality from the academic level on down to the, you know, the organizing on the street, utilizing this new worldview. So that was you know, really powerful. But Elliot, I was really impressed. Excited. The presenters were young, and some of them we've had on our here at Time for Awakening, like Keel Parker.
Okay.
Presented, and he continued to develop geographic exemplar replacement. And you know, I really am proud and appreciative of these young scholars, young thinkers, and, you know, young is relative nowadays, but people who are looking at our situation and trying to figure out what are the ways that we can best understand how to move our people forward and how to better understand who we are as African people. And this, and so he kind of continued to develop that. And, you know, Elliot, when I go to these places now, I'm looking at from this, from a point of an organizer, right? It's, you know, you say that we should develop more think tanks.
Mm-hmm.
And this, that kind of lecture series is where you bring people together who are, have developed their thoughts. So it is somewhat like a think tank. And coming from a, you know, longer view when we being centered, not just being centered in African values and worldview, but being centered in an African civilization like Kemet or, you know, understood as Egypt, so that we understand where people who have a long history and have out of that history have created many strategies, which another presenter I was excited about with was a husband and wife, Geneva and Jeff Weaver. They reviewed the Haitian Revolution, and their point was, and looking at it, it's a blueprint for now that, you know, moving to action. That
wait, say that again, action, Richard, because you broke up your mic. Say that again.
Is a blueprint, the Haitian Revolution, the success of the Haitian Revolution is a blueprint that we should be able to utilize now in doing the work. And they're saying the blueprint center is not only the victory, and I like how they conceptualized that, the victory that we should look at it as a world war, because they did fight three different countries and won. You know, so, you know, to conceptualize it as a world war, for me, you know, gave it another dimension. But to understand that it was centered within the African spiritual, cultural matrix, and took us through how Buchman and Dessalines and and others were centered, you know, in Vudan as the spiritual system, and that gave them the inspiration to kind of win and fight on. And other, you know, other presenters, I was really and this was from 10 o'clock to 6 o'clock.
Okay.
And they were all primarily locals, local, you know, young academics, and I'm not too young, but they're, you know, that, so I give the Philadelphia Mid-Atlantic or the Mid-Atlantic region, Baba Ron McCoy, I give them their props for, you know, continuing on and developing a new cadre of people. One sister, she was 20 years ago, and that was Stephanie Joy Tisdale. You know about what used to be the Dessert Club, and that takes young people to Egypt. Well, she was one who went when she was 15. And now she's, you know, a presenter at ASCAT and dealing with the whole question of who am I and deep thought, you know, and the African worldview. And she communicated how that experience at that young age helped her to navigate to where she is now. That was, you know, powerful. One, you know, in being able to see that. And then it was Dr. Tanika McCoy Nyama. She spoke about the Pan-Africanism. And she said in her, the way it's written is unity and disunity within the African diaspora, Pan-Africanism versus tribalism. But her point was showing, and from her experience, that it will take a lot for us in the diaspora and those in the continent to really, not a lot, it's something we have to continue to work at to create that unification. And that what I use the term, instead of tribalism, ethnation, because of the borders that was set up by Europeans in that, was that 1884, 87, you know, and pulling together different ethnic groups within certain geographies, and the tension that creates under state power, how we, you know, realizing that we have to overcome that, because ethnic nations, they're loyal to their ethnic identity. So in order, you know, the power relationship has to be understood from that point. So again, you know, the day of listening and reflecting and trying to translate how does this assist me personally and us in general as a people and being able to organize ourselves to victory, I was really impressed and inspired and walked away at the end of the day with a lot to mull over as far as just my own personal development and refinement of strategy and tactics.
You know, continuing on this path of looking back to see exactly where we need to go forward to in the future, last week's program with Professor Kemet Shockley and this week's program with historian Mr. Charles White is a continuation of mm-hmm. looking at our past experience, at least here in this diaspora, to look for clues, look for past blueprints to see how we can navigate to move onward towards some type of sovereignty and independence. I ran across Mr. White because of an article that I read out of the New York Times about a East Coast pipeline they wanted to pass through this historic county of Buckingham, Virginia. Then looking into some of the quotes attributed to Mr. White, I seen his work and what he was doing there. So it kind of, the thing of the pipeline, Richard, kind of went to the back burner, because I seen through the 88 years of Mr. White's life, and a good portion of them in that county, he's done yeoman work down there, and we want to have him on to kind of talk about the Informant newspaper that he's editor of, and also that historic Buckingham County in relation to African Americans here in this country. Mr. White, are you with us?
Hello. Yes, I am.
How are you, sir?
Fine. How are you today?
I'm great. I'm happy to have you on Time for Awakening with myself and Brother Richard.
How you doing, Mr. White?
Real pleasure.
Mr. White, as I said to the listening audience, I ran across an article in the New York Times in relation to the pipeline that was supposed to pass through Buckingham County. But the more I read the article, the more the pipeline part went to the back burner, sort of, because I've seen your work of 88 years of being here and a good portion of them in Buckingham County and the historic significance of Buckingham County and some of the icons that came out of that county. Before you talk about some of the work that you've done centered around one of our great icons, talk about Buckingham County and the historic significance of it in relation to African Americans here.
Well, Buckingham, as far as African American history is concerned, this is the birth and childhood home of Dr. Carter G. Woodson, whom most regard as the father of African American history. He was born here on December 19th, 1876. He didn't have much of an opportunity to get an education. There was a freedman bureau school here, and his uncle taught at that school, and he learned all he could. Even basically, his education was very much rudimental. Elementary. He did learn to read, and he became an avid reader. And at age 17, some of his brothers and sisters had moved to the Huntington, West Virginia area. And at age 17, Carter G. Woodson decided to join them. When he... The people there worked on the railroad or worked in coal mines nearby, and he planned to do the same thing. However, when he got to Huntington, he discovered that there was a black high school there, Douglas High School, named after Frederick Douglass. And so he enrolled, and in 2 years he received his high school diploma. In nearby Ohio, there was a small college, trying to recall the name of it, but it admitted blacks. And so he enrolled, and he earned his bachelor's degree. Then he earned a master's degree. He taught school a while in the West Virginia area, and later on he in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And he went on to earn his master's degree from University of Chicago. Then, with great difficulty, he enrolled in the history department of Harvard University, which had only graduated one African-American, and that was W.D. Du Bois, in the field of history. And, of course, he graduated from there. Now, he and Du Bois had a meeting, and they decided what they were going to do with those degrees. And, of course, Louis W. Du Bois felt he should be fighting the segregation and all the problems blacks were having, and so he was one of the founders of the NAACP. However, Carter G. Woodson was concerned because he was had some experiences during college and especially at Harvard about the negativeness of some of his professors about African-American history. And he knew what he was being taught was actually wrong. It wasn't right. And so he decided he'd do something about that. So he devoted his life to studying African-American history. And he wrote 15 books, and he edited hundreds of others, and he couldn't get his work published, and so he founded the the publishing company, Associated Publishers, and that's how he got many of his books printed. So his books are being used today. One of his greatest books was, and is on the market today, and that is The Miseducation of the Negro. And anyone reading that will agree that Carter G. Woodson was way ahead of his time. And that book came out back in the 1930s.
Okay.
And, of course, he died in 1950, I believe it was, 350 or 51. And so I had one teacher in high school that was very close to Carter G. Woodson and knew him well. And he insisted that we learned African-American history every day. Negro history week during that time.
Okay.
But to him, his name was Charles Wesley Yearwood, and he insisted every day, you know, and we got it every day, you know. We got a little black history lesson every day.
No, Mr. White, a question.
Yes, sir.
From what I've read, you came to Buckingham in the early 50s to teach in high school. Am I right?
Yeah, 1956, actually.
Were you from Buckingham or around a neighboring county?
No, I came from 100 miles from Buckingham, a place called Clifton Forge, Virginia.
Okay.
It's near some places you may have heard of, Lexington, Virginia, Roanoke, Hot Springs, Virginia. That's in the western part of Virginia, not West Virginia now, but Western Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Where I grew up was about 30 miles from the West Virginia line.
Okay.
And I came to Buckingham, and my first night I told my father I was out of here. It's no place for me. Then I carried a young lady from Buckingham home for him and my mother to meet.
And that was all she wrote, huh?
Yeah, that was it.
Mr. What?
She stayed with me another week. It'll be 6 or 3 years.
Okay, wow.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Mr. White, a question. When you came to Buckingham to teach in high school, the children that you were teaching, the black children, did they know about Carter G. Woodson? Because he had
Absolutely not.
Now, wait a minute.
I didn't teach history. I taught a course called Building Trades.
Okay.
And I gave those folks what I got in high school, a black history lesson every day.
Okay.
And on one day early in the year, I asked them, you are going to Carter G. Woodson High School. Who was Carter G. Woodson? I remember not a single kid ever heard of him. Yet they were going to college at Wilson High School, and they never thought of who is this hospital, the school I'm going to, who's he named after? Because I proceeded to tell them, and they couldn't believe that he was born here in Buckingham. You mean to tell me the man that started Negro History Month born here in Buckingham? Absolutely. Then I'd ask them, well, where is your home? Well, several said New Canton. That's an area of the county. I said, he was born in New Canton. and they couldn't believe it.
Wow.
So they were fascinated. And so I began to say stuff about Buckingham, and it just one thing led to another. And before I knew it, I was working on a book about African Americans in Buckingham. And I worked on it 12 years and published the first edition of the book I wrote called The Hidden and the Forgotten in 1987. And 2 years ago, I decided to do a reprint of it and worked on that, and I printed that last year. But it greatly expanded and much of the same information in the first edition.
Mr. White, I want to kind of travel down that path of the hidden and forgotten, some of our people that were in Buckingham. But before I do that, because you, Mr. White, you still with us? Mr. White?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good, good. Before I go into that, let me go back to something you said earlier. You talked about Carter G. Woodson graduating from Harvard.
Yeah.
Which W.B. Du Bois had graduated from earlier, and they communicated with one another about how they wanted to proceed.
Yeah.
As far as
what they were going to do with their lives.
Okay.
With this PhD they had.
Now, we've seen what happened with W.B. Du Bois when he was one of the founding members of the NAACP, and some of his life went basically full circle because he lived to be almost 100. But
yeah.
We see that. Also, Carter G. Woodson worked with Marcus Garvey on the newspaper. Was he the editor of the newspaper?
No. He worked with him. He worked with a lot of different people. And anybody was trying to advance African Americans and especially history.
Okay.
Carter G. Woodson got right in it.
Okay.
In the fight, he worked with Marcus Garvey. Another famous man, actually a cousin of his, C.C. Barnett. He was a famous black doctor. He started a hospital in Huntington, West Virginia. And when I was trying to wrap up my first book, I wondered when I'm going to stop finding stuff about Buckingham. I was told to look at Dr. C.C. Barnett, and I did. And I came to find out that I was born in the hospital that Dr. C.C. Barnett founded.
Okay.
And I knew then, or I felt then, I was totally wrong, that there can't be anything else I need to learn about Buckingham and black folks. But Carter G. Woodson worked with anybody that wanted to do something. And he was very critical in his book on the miseducation of the Negro. He was very critical of many people as he saw it. Some well-educated, rich black people. He also talked about things ministers should be doing. He was very critical of the way black spirits were being taught. He got into quite an essay on black businesses. He wrote a book on the black church.
Yes.
And so he was quite a guy. He's one of the people that got in the fight. And he wrote a lot about the NAACP, but he never wrote a whole lot about himself.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, and let's go into that, because you did historical research in Buckingham, and generally, when somebody comes on the scene, they've been nurtured and cultivated by somebody. We see the knowledge that Carter G. Woodson had, and it came out of that town where he was raised, and probably from among people that he closely associated with, whether it's family members, early teachers.
Well, he stayed in a house with a man who had a library that had a lot of black history books in
okay.
it. He rented from a man. That's where he really got his real foundation in African-American history.
Great.
And these are some of the books that were written by black people prior to Carter G. Woodson. There were a lot of authors who wrote African black history books before Carter G. Woodson. and he had access to those. But those books were not, you know, published, and they were, college professors didn't know about them or didn't read them or didn't even believe them if they did read them.
Okay.
And so that's where he got his real start from it.
Now, you know what? Now, you just touched on something, and Richard, I mean, you could attest to this. Now, Carter G. Woodson was born in 1876. So if he had experience reading black history books, then just like you said, these authors, our people were writing these things long before they were being published, so to speak.
Yeah.
Were you aware, or did you run across any of these authors, or even his, what did you say, he lived with his uncle had the library? Who did you say it was?
Yeah, his landlord. He lived with in Huntington.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, Carter G. Woodson in 1926 started publishing a little leaflet called the Negro History Bulletin. Now, my principal had that sent to our library, my little tiny high school library. And we had that. And we also had a book that Carter G. Woodson wrote that was really widely read, was The Negro in Our History. We had that book.
Okay.
And so that's where we got a lot of things, you know, from Carter G. Woodson back then. And, of course, our teachers told us other things, you know. But Carter G. Woodson, what got me so much was in 1941, I was 11 years old when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And I got interested in African-Americans taking part in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And that bothered me. Now, earlier, I had a teacher who gave me knowledge of black cowboys. Now, this was back in about the fourth grade. And I just kept looking at my history books, and they were telling me, this is American history. I said, this is not American history. They're not telling the whole story, you know. And, of course, my teachers agreed. I had one teacher just pull us point, you don't believe half of the stuff you're reading, and this is nothing. This half of it's wrong, you know. And this is our textbook, you know. And but there were, we had teachers who were knowledgeable of black history and whatnot, and they just didn't. The principal who taught math to me said that at one time he worked at a school where the superintendent informed the black teachers they were not to teach anything about slavery or the Civil War, you know. Mm-hmm. And really gave them a warning that they were not to do that.
Okay.
You know? I couldn't believe that, but that's what he told us.
Now, before I pass it over to Brother Richard, I want you to help me with this, Mr. White. Buckingham County, where it seems to me when I'm looking at some of the history that Buckingham was a place, it seemed like that blacks that were free during that period of enslavement, because they had been there quite a while. I'm talking about, I see records from the late 1700s where blacks lived in Buckingham.
Even the 1700s.
Okay.
You know?
So that seemed to be a designated home, so to speak, for blacks that were free, that weren't enslaved, or maybe a white plantation owner died and freed them. They went to Buckingham. They were allowed to go to Buckingham. They had papers saying that they were residents of Buckingham. Am I right?
That's the first I've heard of that part of it. It may have happened.
Okay.
Actually, we had a large free black population in Buckingham.
Okay.
And throughout the entire slave region. Now, Carter G. Woodson wrote two books. And one of them was, I'm getting to the name of it now, it was Negro Slaveholders in 1830. And he listed those black slaveholders county and city by county all over the United States, even Buckingham. And he also wrote a book called Free Negro Landholders and in the United States in 1830. The 1830 census gave a lot of information like that.
Okay.
And a lot of people can't believe that here 35 years before the end of slavery, you had black people who were, had other black people as slaves.
Enslaved, okay.
But you have to explain something. It was not the slavery that you think about. This was a protection thing. If I may just say a word about that.
Go ahead.
If a slave got free, whatever kind of way he did, and there were many ways of getting free, and if he had money, he could purchase a wife or husband or what have you, and to protect that person, he'd have to keep them in slavery. He'd have to list them as his slave, because if he freed them, there was a law that said that that free slave had to leave the state.
Okay.
So they kept them under slaveholders, as slaveholders. And census taker would interview them, taking the census, and ask them, you know, husband, how much land you got with this, that, and the other, and that, do you have any slaves? Are you married? Yes. Where's your slave? There he is. It was a woman, my husband. And Cosby Whitson wrote about a man that bought several wives and sold them.
Okay.
And there's some of his books that are not well known tell a lot about that.
Okay.
And Luther B. Jackson, another historian from Virginia, taught at Virginia State College, university now. He wrote a lot about black people back during slavery and the Reconstruction.
Okay. Brother Richard?
Well, you know, it's interesting what you're saying, Mr. White. But the question that came to my mind is, does Buckingham population now, you know, recognize Dr. Carter Woodson now more than at the time you raised that question to those students?
At the time of Carter G. Woodson, let me go back a little bit further. In 1830, there were 20,000 people in Buckingham. 13,000 were black. 900 and some were free. Now, that was in 1830.
Wow.
Now, in Carter G. Woodson's time, when he was born, black people outnumbered the white people in Buckingham County. And, of course, after the Great Migration, it's less. But today, the black population is about 45%. And there's 17,000 people here in Buckingham now, according to the last census.
And are they more aware about Carter G. Woodson being born there, his early start in Buckingham, than...
The people are aware of it. Now, what we have is a monument, small monument, at his birth site. Just this past Saturday, I'm working with the architecture department at the University of Virginia, and we're working on a traveling display about Carter G. Woodson and a more appropriate marker.
Okay.
At his birth site. We have an organization here. We have a branch of the association here. And I'm the president in name. I let the younger people run the place. They just tell me, you can be the president, we'll do the work. I say, that's fine with me. But anyway, people here, most of the people, it's not the more educated people, and most people here, you know, have a high school education at least. They all know that Carter G. Woodson, and it's told them in school that at Black History Month that this all started by a man from Buckingham, Carter G. Woodson. So I would think you know, if you gave a test to all those black people, yeah, I think 90% of them would say, yes, I know who Carnegie Woodson was, but they may not be able to tell you much else about him, but they know he was father of black history, and he was born here in Buckingham, and where he was born.
Okay.
Let me ask you this, though, Mr. White. Do you, and this kind of expands into the just the history, what do you think a man of your years and have taught in school, how much do you think that we are more aware of black history now than at a time when Carter Woodson was promoting and found a necessity for black history today? Do you think that we're more informed about black history today?
Well, I think so, but I don't think we're sufficiently informed. To give you an example, a television reporter came to Buckingham also quite a few years ago. In fact, it was back in the early 80s, I believe it was, and he wanted to know if students in elementary school knew who Carnegie Woodson was. So we're not telling the students or anybody, just told them this television personality was coming to interview them. So he asked the students, how many of you, well, the principal sent us 10 students. He didn't want the whole student body, he just wanted 10. Now, 6 of these students were black, 4 were white. And they were going to what was Carnegie Woodson High School, because when the schools integrated, they changed the name to Buckingham Junior High School, much to my dissatisfaction.
But wait a minute.
2 years ago, they changed. They did a lot to the school, and now it's called the Carnegie Woodson Complex.
Okay.
Hmm. But going back to this interview that this reporter did, he asked the question, how many of you knew who Carnegie Woodson was? 3 of the white students knew, and I think maybe three or four of the black students knew. So many of them, but one young man didn't know. And he asked the question, well, what team does he play on? They can tell you sports history better than again black history, to my surprise. And of course, this young man that answered that question, I knew his people because they graduated from Carnegie Woodson High School, and I called him up and told him, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. Who Carnegie Woodson was. They said, well, we're sorry, Mr. White. But so I don't think we're sufficiently knowledgeable of it.
And you know, Mr. White, in the example you just gave, I was just talking earlier about the lecture series that I attended, and one of the speakers, he took 2 young people, and he asked them, he gave them historical names, black historical names, and asked, did they know who they were, or for them to explain it, and they couldn't. He gave them Ninja Turtles, the name of the Ninja Turtles. They were able to explain who they were and what. And he also asked, well, did they know about Wakanda? And they were able to explain what was Wakanda and what was the Black Panther in Wakanda. So yeah. I'm only reemphasizing the point. And you were saying that took place in 1980, and this is 2018. Yeah. And that's Virginia, and this is Philadelphia, and the state of recognizing the history. So, you know, it's interesting with how much work we have to do.
Yeah, well, that's true. Let me just say this. When Alex Haley finished up Roots on television, my oldest 3 children had been born. I have a 4th now, but the oldest 3 have been born. And let's see, one of them was 8, I believe, and the other was 5, and the other was 4. And I just asked him, what was my mom and dad's name? Well, my oldest child, my daughter, she knew her mother's people, grandmother, because she lived right across the road. But my people, my daughter said she thought that my daddy's name was Willie, because I had a brother named Willie Jr. She knew enough that if he was junior, he must have been a junior senior. The two boys had no idea. And now, why that was, I hadn't told them.
Okay.
However, yes. All of them, their children and grandchildren, they know now, because when they come around Uncle Charles now, or Grandpa, they better have some stuff ready, because he's going to ask them.
And that's the tenacity we have to have.
Yeah, they say, when Uncle Charles asks, you better get some stuff ready about this history of our family. One of the things that I'm most proud of, I have some people from Buckingham and some other people, too, that have the hidden and forgotten has sort of inspired them to look into their family history.
Okay.
One of the people actually lives in Philadelphia, Mrs. Grace McCollum. She's written extensively on her family, the Lewis Spencer family in Buckingham. And I have about six or seven families who've done some extensive work on their families. And I've done it on my family. And some of them have said that I wonder if the young people would appreciate this. I told them, well, what I tell mine, here it is. Whether you like it or not, whether you learn it or not, whether you remember it or not, here it is. Don't say anybody's hiding this from you.
Okay.
You just need to read it. And of course, my oldest niece said, well, Uncle Charles, you've taught us well. So I said, well, I hope you pass it on. But I have written my whole family, and I found out that my earliest ancestor was a slave in Bedford, born actually before the Revolution. She was born in 1780. And actually before the United States became a United States. She was born in 1780. And I can cut the family all the way down through the history, down to the very youngest member of the family now. And I tell him, here it is now. You don't say somebody's hiding this from you. You don't say it doesn't exist. Or don't say you can't find it.
And my last question on this is, do you think Carter Woodson's, what he laid out in the Miseducation of Negro, still is, I mean, you said it was written in 1930. Is it still, the element still true today as he seen it then?
Yes, at a meeting I had at the University of Virginia with these students about Carter G. Woodson, one of the professors said, you know, so much of what Carter G. Woodson said way back then is certainly he's way ahead of his time, because what he was saying back then with experiences today. And he just felt that you don't have a good education unless you got to know your history.
Okay.
And I had a professor in college just point blank tell us that chapter in our book, our American United States, it was called United States, Virginia and U.S. History, was the name of that book that we had. And every chapter, we had to look up something and report on it about black people during that period. And they used to tell us, don't call yourself educated unless you know the history of your people. And that was Professor Scott Williams. I'll never forget him. But he was an exponent of Carter G. Woodson, too.
Let me go to call here. Let's go to Newport News. How are you, sir?
Good evening, gentlemen. And Mr. White, hello to you. I'm on the other side of Virginia, down in Yorktown, Virginia. And Yorktown, Virginia.
Yorktown.
Yes, sir. So you know what? The school I went to was James Weldon Johnson, and one of the first books I got from Mrs. Morgan, the librarian, because I was a bad little kid in the first three or four grades because I learned to read early. So doing the homework and the classwork, I always get in mischief. She sent me to the library. The Negro in our history, the other person that was involved in that was Charles H. Yeah. Wesley. And he ended
Charles
up...
Charles Wesley, I had dinner with him once.
And so you'll know what I was about to say. One of the universities that he was involved with was Wilberforce.
Yeah.
And I think the other one was like Ohio Central or something like that. They were fairly close together, right, at that Kentucky-Ohio border.
Yeah.
But the thing I wanted to say is I'm so glad you talked about the importance of telling your family, because I've been on a couple of platforms and I tell people I'm 65. The thing that really bothers me is we spent about two generations running from blackness instead of understanding the essential part of knowing exactly what your blackness is all about.
Yeah.
And I really applaud your work, and I want to make sure before you get off here, because I want to hear you talk more. I don't want to keep rambling, but to find out how we can connect with you, because you say you have those youngsters that are doing that work with you, and I'd certainly like to be able to hook up and find out exactly what's going on and help in any way I can, sir.
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, you know, a lot of black folk are connected with George Washington and Joe Cornwallis at Yorktown.
Oh, yes, sir. But you also understand those people, Mr. Wesley and all of them, they got educations at Yale and Harvard, and then they also were instrumental in Howard and Hampton University. You know, I'm close by with Norfolk State and Hampton, Virginia State, Virginia Commonwealth, and those people were instrumental in setting up departments in all of those schools. They didn't they weren't just at that one or two facilities. They actually connected a lot of these historically black colleges. That's all I wanted to say. I applaud your work.
Yeah. Well, Virginia University has it now. Goes a little school I went to, St. Paul's, is no longer existing. But Virginia State has quite a collection now. And I know Hampton's always had it.
Okay.
Yeah. And Virginia Union has quite a department, too.
Now, Mr. White, you wear several hats as a publisher of The Informant. How long has The Informant been in existence, and why did you start it?
Well, the hidden and the forgotten. I had a cousin who I didn't know was my cousin until later, had a little newspaper in Charlottesville.
Okay.
His son interviewed me on the Charlottesville radio station. His dad was publishing this little newspaper called the Charlottesville Tribune. Dad listening in on it, told his son he wanted to interview me when that book came out, and he did. I called him a book and sat down and talked with him. I learned that he was a Buffalo soldier. He was 90-something years old. He'd been a Buffalo soldier. And he wanted to know about the book and Buckingham and all, and so he knew people in Buckingham and all. And so I asked him about this newspaper. He went into this long history of his how he got started with the newspaper and all his struggles. So his name was Randolph White, actually. Actually, he was my grandfather's second cousin. But anyway, I didn't know that at the time. But anyway, I told him I'd got to get back to Buckingham, so he just said, boy, why don't you start a newspaper over there in Buckingham? And I didn't know, you know, I said, that's crazy, you know, I can't hear nothing about no newspaper, starting no newspaper. And I said, well, now, if he did it, maybe I can. And, of course, when I got about halfway home, it kept bothering me what he said. I just, as soon as I crossed the river over into Buckingham, I said, I'm going to do it. I don't care what's going to happen, but I'm going to start a newspaper. And, of course, I told my wife when I walked in the house that I'm going to start a newspaper. Her response was, you're going to do what? She was knocked off her feet. But she's my biggest helper now.
Okay.
But okay. It's 30-something years. It was 1987. And that's when it started. The first edition was 1987. And we've published totally a monthly. But every month I give them some history, and so many people like this last issue, this current issue, really. somebody learned this. We had a black general that died a couple of months ago, and some of his own relatives did not know it. And they were having a birthday party for a 99-year-old member in, I think it was Cincinnati, it's in Kentucky. And someone just mentioned his name, but a person from Buckingham who took my paper said, well, he died some time ago, and we didn't know it, you know. And so he told him, well, how did you find out about it? He said, well, I saw it in the informant.
Okay.
And I got a couple of informants. I got a mail to some of those people now about his death. But some members of the family just didn't notify other members. And it wasn't in all of the newspapers. I think my paper's the only one in the state of Virginia that's carried it, that I know anything about it. I know none of our local newspapers carried it. And our major newspapers, such as the Richmond Times-Dispatch, Charlottesville Progress, or the Lynchburg Daily Advance, none of them carried it. But my paper's the only one that cared about this general's death, and he was quite a man.
Mr. White, a couple of things before we start winding things down. The being that Virginia is one of the oldest colonies which became a state in this country, blacks have been here almost since the well, we know that blacks were here before Europeans, but during the time of our enslavement, we came here basically almost the same time as Europeans did.
Well, actually, there are records that show that blacks came here even before
Columbus. Well, yeah, yeah. I realize that, but I'm just talking about that as far as the enslavement of a lot of our ancestors. But
they were with the explorers.
Yes.
When, all those explorers like Columbus and Balboa and DeSoto and all, those fellas had blacks on their ships.
Mm-hmm. As navigators, yes.
And then they were guests, you know. And another thing people don't know, the first blacks that came to Virginia did not come as slaves. And the people that they said got off this ship, this Dutch ship in 1619, some of our history books say that they came as slaves. They were not slaves. Slavery came a couple of decades later.
Mm-hmm.
These people were indentured servants.
Okay.
And as the slavery developed around 1660, between the 50s and the 60s. And that's when they became afraid of the blacks, you know. That's when they passed the law that blacks couldn't own weapons. They were a little concerned. There were so many of them here, and some of them were dissatisfied with their condition, even as indentured servants. So they passed the law that blacks couldn't own any kind of a weapon. Still another later law said that any blacks coming from a heathen country will become a slave, a heathen country.
Yeah. Mr. White, the question I want to ask is, being that blacks had been in Buckingham since the 1700s, early to mid-1700s, how did our people fare from your historical research during the time of the Gabriel Prosser Rebellion, and especially after 1831 and Nat Turner? Because go ahead.
That's interesting. I got a little bit about that in my book.
Go ahead.
Nat Turner actually set off a wave of fear.
Okay.
But before him, that was Gabriel Prosser in Richmond. And if Gabe probably had pulled off his rebellion, we don't know what would have happened. But Gabe Palmer had planned a massive slave rebellion to the point of capturing the governor. But a slave got cold feet and sold him out. And they arrested Gabe and some of his lieutenants. But the governor interviewed him because he couldn't get any information from him. And one slave shocked them all, and this is recorded, that he told them, "You all getting ready to hang me." no point in me telling you anything. I'm not. He went to his grave not telling him anything.
Wow.
But Nat Turner set off something because he pulled it off. And it struck fear all through the South. There was an incident here in Buckingham 2 years after the Nat Turner Rebellion.
Okay.
Where one morning some slave men were walking down the road and someone, a white person, was probably on slave watch, saw them from a distance, and they know he saw that they were carrying weapons. And he reported that to the sheriff, and nobody knew anything about it. They couldn't get into blacks to tell them anything about any rebellion being planned. And the governor sent a battalion of troops here, militia, and they came to find out that these guys were not carrying weapons, they were just carrying picks and shovels. And another slave owner later wrote to a friend that a slave had run off and gotten captured, and she said her father had thought about whipping him, but he thought better of it because of our state of affairs, this fear we have, you know, of these blacks now. And many people don't realize that white people had slaves, they were scared to death of them. You know, they didn't know what they were going to do. And there were rebellions all over the place. There were some rebellions right here in Buckingham. One lady, one mother had her children sold. The owner said that she would moan for them for a couple of days and forget about them, like a hog or a cow or something. She didn't forget about them. She kept it in her mind, and she started, said they were going to lose her children. She was going to kill her children, their children. She put glass in their food, in their bread, and the kids start bleeding. Come find out they had glass all through their body waste, and they disposed of her. And I don't know what they did to her.
Wow.
Another woman lost her children, and she set the house on fire. And while the owners were at church, is when she set the house on fire. And when the owners came back, were told in church that their house was near burned to the ground, they rushed back and found the woman standing on the front porch. And as soon as they came in the yard and came up close to her, she ran in back and got in the fire and died.
Oh, wow.
So those are some of the things that happened, you know. They beat one slave, and he killed the horses and killed a whole lot of stuff and then ran and jumped in the James River, drowned. So you don't hear that kind of stuff. They don't write that kind of stuff. But that's in manuscript material. And
Go ahead, Richard.
A lot went on.
What was the owners of these plantations, what were their primary business? Was it plantation that growing cotton, or was it something else?
Well, after they passed the law that slaves couldn't be exported from Canada, in many of the plantations, the product was slaves. Mm-hmm. So they raised slaves to be sold to plantation owners down in the Deep South. The Upper South, which the land had been ruined by tobacco, and they became the slave suppliers, the breeding areas.
Wait a minute, Mr. White. Hold on a second. Let's walk slow with this one. Now, you said that the land had been ruined by tobacco?
Yeah,
tobacco's not, you grow it and don't rotate, as I understand it. It ruins the land. It renders the land so you can't do much with it.
Right.
Now, I don't know that much about it, but they said that tobacco is something that just really takes so much from land.
Okay. So you said a lot of the plantations in Buckingham were basically slave farms.
Yeah. But now they raise tobacco, a little bit of tobacco. They raise other crops, too, that they sold. We had a canal that came from Richmond through Buckingham and along the James River. And they raised tobacco, still raised tobacco, and they raised corn and other crops and a lot of corn whiskey. But one slave was sold in 1849 and carried to Alabama. But he was lucky that he got under a owner who allowed him to learn to read and write. And he did. And he grew up and became a college president, a founder. He founded Selma University in Alabama, Selma, Alabama. And he happens to be the grandfather of the wife of John Johnson, the publisher of Ebony. Eunice is John Johnson's wife. She died some years ago. But this man was her grandfather.
Okay.
And so some slaves were better off when they got sold, you know, but most of them weren't. So okay. Everything happened, you know, black people back in those days.
You know, and that's one, the thing of human breeding, that's one subject in relationship to African-American history is not real. It's starting to come up more now, but hasn't been really developed as far
I know
as,
it. That's what I was said. That's what I was going to mention, Richard. Just what you said, because that's one area that is rare. It's never talked about by Europeans, and they were doing it. But it's one area that we don't really know too much about, but we have evidence of a lot of this stuff going on.
And a lot of records.
Okay.
About Thomas Jefferson. I tell this to you, I have some some sympathy from John Thomas Jefferson. He had a relationship with a black woman, and once he had that, he couldn't help himself. But anyway, that happened a lot. Now, he had a good buddy over here on the James River in Buckingham who, like Thomas Jefferson, lost his wife when she was young, and he selected three slaves to be his mistresses. And one of those slaves has children, has descendants here in Buckingham right now, and I attended church this morning with some of them. They know who they are, and they know that their ancestor is white, you know. But so much of that has happened, and there's a whole lot of inbreeding here, and it was not all, you know, it worked from both sects, too, you know.
Okay.
Because we have some blacks here in Buckingham had a white mother, and they come out of the slavery area time, too. So a little bit of everything went on. You name it, it went on in slavery, doing slavery.
Oh, definitely.
Mr. White,
anything you can think of happened.
Before you leave us, if you want to mention anything about that pipeline going through, because I know that it's been a lot of conflicting stories in reference to it.
Well, a lot of conflicting stories on it. So is it that the black communities torn apart? No, that's not so. We still love each other. We still go to church and visit each other. A few of us disagree with it, and we're not disagreeable, but we do have a few people, very, very few people who are disagreeable. The whole thing is going to be decided in the next few days, because the holdup is a problem that the environmental air people had with the emission from the pump compression station. And that's supposed to be cleared up by now, and they're supposed to have another hearing on it on the 19th. That's this week. And it is expected that they will give the go-ahead to the company. And I'm expecting construction to start just as soon as it's ground dries out a little bit. We've had a lot of snow and rain in the last few days.
Oh, snow and rain? Oh, keep it down there, Mr. White, please. Just keep it down there.
Mr. White.
Well, you don't never know when it starts coming. See, this thing, it develops because it's coming right through a neighborhood called Union Hill. And I read about a slave cemetery in that area, 400 and some slaves buried there. And that sort of gave some people the attitude that the whole community was a historic community. Well, it has that, so it's not, you know, the whole community is not a historic community.
Okay.
And then they also said it was a primarily a black, an African-American community. No, it's only 40% African-Americans in that neighborhood.
Okay.
So a lot of misinformation.
Okay.
But it's all going to be over soon. And something like that, you know, say it's 600 miles coming out of West Virginia down through Buckingham and going into North Carolina. And I don't think a little community here in Buckingham was going to stop it. But there are some people who think they did, but I think they're going to be find out that's not quite going to be what happened.
One, a couple more things before you leave us, Mr. White. The I lost my train of thought because I had an article here. Mr. White, the historical significance of Virginia, as far as our ancestors being involved down there, doing different things that led to our historical experience here in this country. Do you find that, because I know that you were involved in getting that monument or plaque for Carter G. Woodson down there in Buckingham. Do you find it's easier in a state like Virginia to get them to, whether it's the parks and rec, I don't know who handles it in your state, to provide monies to get these areas designated as historical areas?
Well, yes, a whole lot is being done now. The Carter G. Woodson site in New Canton is on the a trail sponsored by the Virginia Humanities Council, which is funded by, in great part, by the state.
Okay.
It is on a civil rights and education trail that leads from Petersburg to Lynchburg. And there are markers all along the way. And the flagship marker is the R.R. Moton Museum in Farmville. That's where schools were closed for 4 years to avoid integration. But the Carter G. Woodson site is on that, plus a few other sites here in Buckingham. And they come, and Appomattox, and because Appomattox is right up the road from Buckingham, next county.
Okay.
And so a lot is being done. There are markers and at the state capitol, the young lady that led the student strike in Farmville back in 1951 that led in part to Brown versus Board of Education, there is a monument to her on the state capitol. And there are two state buildings named after two lawyers that were connected with the integration fight. And so a lot is being done. You know, we've elected a governor here, black governor in Virginia. And also blacks played a major role in the days ending the Civil War with the Battle of Petersburg and this Battle of the Crater where so many black soldiers got killed, and a whole division of black troops, of the United States colored troops, actually pursued Lee from Richmond. Because when Petersburg fell, Lee went into Richmond. He couldn't stay there, so he started headed south toward trying to get to Lynchburg, to Danville. But he had a whole division of black troops tracing behind him, along with hundreds of other whites. When he surrendered to Appomattox, there were thousands of black troops there facing him. Plus, he had slaves who also were there. And that's never mentioned. But there are some of these slaves have descendants here in Buckingham right now who were at Appomattox when Lee surrendered.
Yeah, so wait a minute.
Carter G. Woodson's father was there.
He ran to his home, you're saying?
I'm sorry.
You said he ran to his home when he was being pursued.
Collier G. Woodson's father, James Henry Woodson, was a slave in Fluvanna County over the next county to Buckingham. And he was sent out one day to dig ditches for another white person. And this person had, the two of them had trouble. And the white employer slapped him or something, and the slave beat him half to death. And he went home, gathered up his things, and warned his owner not to follow him, threatened him to kill him if he followed him. But he went back across the river, and he ran into some northern troops, and they were of Joe Sheridan's army in Richmond. And he was placed finally in George Armstrong Custer's division of cavalry troops. And Collier G. Woodson said he was there when Lee surrendered in Appomattox. And Custer's unit was there.
Okay.
So that's not talked about, too, that black troops were, some of the black troops were there when they surrendered. And I have found, and I got it written in the book, that all I found quite a number of black soldiers who were in the United States colored troops. And many of them were wounded and killed and captured. And so they, some of the things they wrote about it, so many of them became Buffalo soldiers later on.
Before you...
In the military, blacks have been served in all of the war, beginning with George Washington, all the way up to Vietnam. I had 13 former students got wounded over there, and two were killed. So they were Buckingham young men. Okay. I taught them, and I lost some other people I know. A playmate got killed in a plane crash. So we've been at it for a long time.
Before you leave us, Mr. White, tell folks how they can get the book, The Hidden and Forgotten. Tell them how they can order the informant paper if some of our listeners are interested in getting it.
Well,
receiving.
The paper is $15 a year, same thing it's been for the last 13 years.
You haven't raised the price? What's going on?
but all you need is just write the informant. And it's $15 a year, and it comes out every month. Now, the new...
Now, give me that address.
The Forgotten.
Give me that address.
For the same address.
Go ahead.
And I'm going to give you the address.
Go ahead.
And that's $45, and it costs $3 to mail it. It's a much larger book and everything. But it's the Informant, INFORMANT, and it's 3268. Shelton Store Road, S-H-E-L-T-O-N, Store Road, Buckingham, Virginia, 23921. And we mail out usually the next day or two. And we have quite a few of the books left, because we can order some more when we run out. But I don't last much longer. I won't be able to go because I told I'm 88 years old.
Yeah, well.
One person told me I want to buy the next book you write, Mr. White. And I told him, I'm 88 years old, honey. I don't know if any more books can be coming out.
You're still doing the work, Mr. White, and you got those cadre of young people that's with you. They're gonna keep you young and keep you spry and keep you working.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. Somebody told me you'll be appreciated more once you're gone, but that's what happened to Carter G. Woodson, too, you know.
Okay.
So somebody, that's nothing unusual, but I plan to leave it here, and you can read it, not buying or not, whatever, it's yours. Here it is, and that's... So don't say nobody's hiding it from you.
Mr. White,
and I also include in the book where all this information came from.
Okay.
And I got it. Now, because some of the information people are going, because I interviewed a lot of people, and some of them were, you know, ancestors, grandchildren of slaves. I actually, up until I was 13, I lived around six slaves. My great grandmother was one.
Okay.
And they were extremely old people, and I was just a little kid. And I heard them talking, but I dared not ask a question. He interrupted older people talking. He'd get killed. But I remember some of the things that I heard them talking about.
Oh, and you know, before we leave, Mr. White, you mentioned to me in private conversation that several of I don't know whether it's several, but you said that Carter G. Woodson still has family in Buckingham.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. There are some relatives here of his mother. The Riddles were their name. R-I-D-D-L-E. Some of them are here, and there is one great niece of Carter G. Woodson here. Her name is Jessie Woodson Johnson, and she was a member of the Board of Supervisors here. And the Carter G. Woodson Foundation, the Family Foundation, is planning to come to Buckingham next summer for a reunion.
Okay.
And this is why we want to get this new marcus, you know, up and going when they get here.
Okay.
But there are people here, and there are some people, relatives of Carter G. Woodson's in West Virginia.
Good. Okay.
Well, Carter G. Woodson did not have children. And so these children are nieces and nephews. He had a lot of nieces and nephews because he had a lot of brothers and sisters.
Okay.
Nine of them, to be exact.
I want to thank you for being with us, Mr. White, and giving us this valuable information. And I'm going to be contacting you personally next week sometime because I need your help. You know, what we discussed in private conversation. I need your help on this, and I know that you can help me.
Yeah. Okay. I may have some of the information you need.
Great.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right.
And take care now.
Yes, sir. Bye.
We're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back. We're expecting Brother Oba to come in with us in conversation. He ought to be here soon. If not, we're going to transition in open forum. You can get involved, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Time for Awakening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me had held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
I'm not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you've called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP or the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the Slave Theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we are black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put them anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Encourage, let me just say this before our time winds up, and that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lauren Green sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and I want to thank again historian Charles, Mr. Charles White, for joining us this evening to talk about the historic county of Buckingham, Virginia, and the life of Carter G. Woodson. Richard, it was an interesting conversation, and some things that you didn't know about Carter G. Woodson and some things that I definitely didn't know about that county.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it's always not, well, I wouldn't use the term good to hear, but it's always definitely very encouraging when you see people, period, whether they're some of our elders or young people that want to preserve the memories of our ancestors in some form or fashion, whether it's verbal, keeping them alive, or sharing their works, books, maybe their childhood homes, places that they went when they were youth, and preserving these things as monuments so our youth can relive and understand who these men and women were. You know, it's just because I know that he's been working on these things for quite a while. You could see that Carter G. Woodson and people that were that touched Carter G. Woodson's life touched his life. So right. It was almost personal to him to keep these things and keep these memories alive. So
it's just interesting how to, you know, and I'm focusing on, you know, especially the point that you made when he said about it was the person that Carter G. Woodson stayed with that had these books, right, that inspired him to the history that he, you know, took on as a life work, you know. And to know that these activities are going on by individuals, you know, when we, you know, I've been saying lately, we got a lot of jobs. You may not get paid for it, but we got a lot of jobs. And that's another good example of a job. This person was collecting, not just collecting, but this was their work. And by having that, I mean, this is non-published and, you know, in the general society, but having that library in his house and then by some circumstance being able to have this young man come in his house and then be exposed, you know, motivated and excited, and from that carry it on to life work. This is something that is uniquely to our particular African experience, right? I mean, you know, and the question is, not do we know a series of names, but do we know, understand that kind of network exists? It exists now. Yes, we have institutions, but, you know, there's people, you know, call them elders, you know, or, you know, call them OGs, or, you know, call them what you want. There's people who invested their time and energy that could influence the next generation. That to me is powerful. That is power, and that is powerful.
Yeah, I agree. You know, we got to, I remember Amma Mazama, Dr. Amma Mazama at Temple. She was on the program, I don't know, it might have been 4 years ago. And she was talking about our people holding things sacred, and that other people have things that they hold sacred, and that generally our people don't really hold things sacred. And when you look into what she was saying and the premise of her assertion, she was right to a great degree. And it just reminded me when I'm listening to Mr. White talk about his love for Carter G. Woodson and his work, and that he wanted to preserve that. And even he's an older man now. He's 88 years old.
Right.
And he said he's going, you know, he wants to make sure that this stuff is ready for next year when they have a reunion of Carter G. Woodson's family. So, I mean, you know, hopefully he's here. But he said he got a group of young people, and they're going to make sure that if he gets called away, that they're going to carry on and pass the baton. So you can see that that whole thing is intergenerational and is working, right, Richard.
That intergenerational transmission of information,
yeah.
Production, even the production. And now, and if I can interject, because in this discussion, there's two elements that came up, and I want to tie that to that production analogy, because Virginia is going to be, for this 2019, the epic center of defining 400 years of the American African experience here. And it's just, you know, as we talk about what young people know about Carter G. Woodson, know about African-American history in general, even what we as adults are not really sharing. You know, we have these individuals who are doing this life work, but then in general, what we're not sharing, so that these young people are aware of it, or that our narrative. So because I'm really concerned, Elliot, that if they get into crafting a narrative that we were immigrants that came to the shores of Virginia, you know, as indentured, and our quest for freedom, you know, is a part of the American experience that ties to the making of the Declaration or the Constitution, even to the Civil War. I have a challenge with that. If that becomes the narrative that comes out of this, when the whole thing which came out of this discussion of human breeding as a business, as a business.
He said it was big business in Buckingham.
And when you read the historical narrative, especially after 1808, when they couldn't legally do no more importation, and then they started opening up the Deep South and were looking towards the Midwest, which, you know, I mean, they needed that labor. Yes, it became big business, but, you know, it's how do we narrate that as a part of the American experience? Because if we just make it an immigration story, we came to the shores and yeah, we had some roughneck white folks and, you know, and some laws was against us, but then, you know, out of our tenacious will to be Americans, we've had the laws changed through the civil rights. If we create that kind of narrative, that doesn't square to me, of degrading, dehumanizing, and producing human beings for labor, free labor, that creates a wealth that we still are not sharing in. And I ain't looking for others to create that narrative. So I'm not necessarily hearing how we square in that narrative.
And Richard, there's another conversation that comes out of that, is the behaviors. We've already seen the negative behaviors that stem from our experience with Europeans and that period of enslavement. Mm-hmm. What kind of negative behaviors stem from that, what we just talked about and right. what you just mentioned? Because you can see that there's some type of negative behaviors that stem from that.
No control. And to have, again, what Mr. White, you know, brings up, even we're talking to somebody who says that around him and his growing up, there were people who were of that lived experience. Now, we're talking to him now. So we're talking about something in some distant past.
Yeah.
Right? You know, and somebody, when you talk about that lived experience, somebody who didn't have some influence from that lived experience, or when we're talking about Carter Woodson using that house and getting that information from somebody who collected, who recognized that it was necessary, that even his own family was engaged in the liberation of a people, his people, not fighting a war between states, but the liberation of a people. That's a different context. And I don't know if America is really able to handle it.
We got a couple calls on hold, but you know, before I go to the phones, Richard, let me, because I just wanted to share this article because, you know, I thought about Dr. Mazama when she was mentioning about black folks holding things sacred. And, you know, listening to the conversation with Mr. White. And let me read this article and to kind of tie it in. Because I thought this article was I mean, it gives us something to think about. And it published a report dated, and it was in Atlanta Black Star on Thursday. Martin Luther King's childhood Atlanta home sold to the federal government. Dr. Martin Luther King's childhood home is no longer in the hands of the King family. This week it was announced that the historic site located in Auburn Avenue in Atlanta was sold to the National Park Service. The two-story home was sold for $1.9 million, according to sources of CBS 46. Although neither the King Center for Nonviolent Social Change nor the National Park Service confirmed the amount. The home was purchased in 1909 for $3,500 by King's maternal grandfather, who was the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church. Dr. King was born there in January 15, 1929. The Congress declared it a National Historic Site in 1980. The house had been owned by the King family and later the King Center for more than 100 years, but now has been placed in the hands of the federal government. The King's family negotiated a sale of the property in late November. The National Park Foundation stated the organization facilitated through a private philanthropy the purchase of the Martin Luther King birth home and its immediate transfer to the National Park Service. The transfer closed on November 27, 2018. In 1982, the National Park Service began offering tours to the home on behalf of the King Center. Since then, the Park Service has been maintaining the home for more than 30 years. Richard, what do you think about that? And considering that they've sold everything, his Bible, his underwear, you know, and now the home that was in that family since 1909. What do you think about that? Is there anything, tying it in with Dr. Mazama, is there anything sacred? Is there anything that, you know, you can't maintain that home that your great-grandfather passed down to his father and to your father? And you, come on, man, what is this? Does money mean that much? Have we adopted these European values where money is everything? Like the Europeans say, everybody got a price. That's their motto. But should it be our motto too, that everybody has a price? And they're going to use this just like you said. Tourism is big business. And some of these tourisms to black people's homes and sites is big business. They wouldn't get involved in it if it wasn't.
And they're going to shape the story. I mean, the most threatening thing of this kind of warfare, and you know, whether it is running from blackness or you know, just trying to get another way to get paid, or you know, being somewhat understanding, you know, because I seen in that article where it was, you know, there was thrown out, well, the federal government can protect it more than being under private hands.
Oh, get the hell, come on. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, okay, I mean, that's, you know, the rationality.
Well, yeah, I know, yeah, uh-huh.
You know, but the thing is, and you know, still goes to your point from principle in relationship to sacred. At some point, we have to take something and hold on to it, just so that we can be able to hold on to the narrative, not necessarily for tourism, but to be able to educate the next generation of what the vision, mission, and objectives are.
Mm-hmm.
That's having these material assets. That's what they're primarily for, especially when we're talking about transferring it from one generation to the other. That's what Africans did. They built big things that last. And that's why we celebrate Kemet, Egypt. You can't get to building nothing that's going to last so that the next generation can see, other than something like that. And we got it in Zimbabwe. We got it in South Africa. We got it in caves and rock art. memory stick, something sacred. So that's, so when you ask me what I think, that's, you know, it upsets me, Elliot. Maybe it's really fear, but it upsets me. Fear that we're just not recognizing that once we lose our memory, we're back to being non-human.
Well, we can't control their behavior, but it just, you know, listen, that man, he did a lot of work here, and especially the later part of his life when he started changing and adopting other thoughts and things of that nature. If he knew things that was going on by his, the man's rolling over in his grave. I mean, this is crazy. But, you know, you can't. That's what they do. You find, you see a lot of his sons and daughters doing a lot of crazy things now, supporting Trump. Mm-hmm. And I mean, everything from supporting Trump to selling everything that they can get his hands on. Mm-hmm. They found a toothbrush that he used to have. They might sell that. Yeah, come on, man. Some of these people, I don't know. Let's go to 267. 267?
Yes. I'm Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm Richard. Yes, yeah, sir. I wanted to talk to that guy from Buckingham, man, West Virginia. I had a lot of questions I wanted to ask him.
Virginia. No, Virginia, not West Virginia.
I said what? What'd you say?
Virginia, not West Virginia.
Oh, okay, from Virginia. Okay, sure. But I know that Carl G. Wilson worked in the coal mines of West Virginia. I know he did that.
Yeah, he discussed that he went over there with his family, but later came back.
Oh, that's how it went. Yeah. Okay. He talked about a book too, didn't he?
Yes.
What he's doing?
Well, he did that book about 30 years ago.
Oh, okay. You didn't take too many calls on it?
Well, I mean, you got something to say about it, Tim? You were listening, man. You got something to say in reference to it?
No, I want to talk to him. That's all I said. I didn't.
Oh, well, listen.
I only heard one person. That's all.
Let me give that address again for the informant and the book, The Hidden and the Forgotten. You can get involved and get a subscription to the paper, The Informant, which has been in printing, that he has been printing now for over 30 years.
Right.
The Informant newspaper is 3268 Shelton Store Road, Buckingham, Virginia, 23921. Again, that's 3268 Shelton Store Road, Buckingham, Virginia, 23921. And that's for the book, The Hidden and the Forgotten, or to get a yearly subscription to the Informant newspaper.
Right. What's his first and last name again?
Mr. Charles W. White.
Charles W. White, Hidden and Forgotten. Yeah. Okay, yeah. It was a good conversation with y'all.
All right,
what's
bro.
Going, everything, huh?
No, go ahead.
No, I was just saying what you were talking about with the King family, man. That's an issue, man. That's a problem, man. But this is what happens, man. I guess our people don't see the value of family.
Well,
on things and passing it down.
Well, evidently they don't, but, you know, they don't.
Yeah.
All right, brother.
All right, man. Talk to you.
Thank you. Let's go to 404. 404.
Hey, Brother Elliot, Brother Richard. Y'all hear me?
How are you, yes, sir?
Hey, I'm down here in Atlanta, man. I see two scenarios. One scenario is you got my man Fred Hampton Jr. He asked for donations to save his dad's house, right? Okay, with PayPal, right?
Okay.
So, okay, now you, the other flip of the coin, the King family, right? Okay, I'm down here in Atlanta, man. I've been to the King Center about four or five times, man, and they got a jar on the counter. As you walk out the door, ask for donations, man. And I see people, nobody put no money in the pot. Every time I go down there, I put some money in the jar, man. Okay, it's up to us. We could, I think what Bernie should have done, like my man Fred Hampton Jr. did, and said, if people set a PayPal account or whatever, to ask for donations to save the King and family house. But look at them two boys, especially Dexter. He's money hungry, man. Okay, something wrong. I mean, he's traumatized. They're traumatized, man. See your daddy shot down like that. I mean, that's traumatizing right there. So, I mean, but the park service, they do maintain everything, man. I've been to the church, the old Ebenezer Church, and the King Center. You see them park rangers there all through the property. They maintain the place, man. And so I look at it two ways, man. All these, it's some rich folks in Atlanta. They could have went to the rich people and got on the radio and say, we need money to preserve it. It's always two or three different ways to do things, man. So this costs money to preserve a house. I kind of agree with you that they sold it to the federal government, whatever, whatever. But at least it'll be preserved, man. That's the way I'm looking at it, man.
Well, preserve for who?
Park rangers, they do.
But preserve for who?
Well, people to come. It's a museum, man. It's a museum. That's all it is, a museum now.
Yeah, but they can easily change the narrative. For example, that's the house that...
I don't do that narrative shit, man. Everybody say that narrative.
You don't do it, man. But it's a reality. That it's a reality.
Yeah, I know it's a reality, man. But at least it's just a museum. Look at Mega Ever's house, man. Okay, I go to these places, man. And so far, enough, Mega Ever's house is being preserved. I see your point, Elliot. I see your point. They sold it to the federal government, whatever.
Yeah, but they don't have to. Listen, Wes, they don't have to sell anything to the federal government. The federal government killed those men. I want you to understand. Hold it. The federal government killed those men. You don't have to sell it. You're going to sell a murderer, somebody that murdered your father, the property? Man, get out of here. You got lawmakers down there. You got John Lewis and others down there that's supposed to be lobbying for black folks. You don't allow. That's why when I asked the chairman when he was on there, the federal government, along with the Chicago police, admitted that they conspired to murder his father. And what was the black lawmakers doing in Chicago to try to get money to save that place? See, you're obligated as a black person to help your brother. You're supposed to be, if you know anything about your culture or your people.
The point I'm trying to make is they did not.
I ain't for selling nothing to no federal government. They murdered their father.
Ellie, all they had to do, King's family had to say is we need money to preserve it, and the community would have came together and gave them money, man. They ain't doing no good puppet size, man. I agree with you, Ellie.
Okay.
I agree with you 100%, man. They went about it the wrong way, man. All they had to do was go to the people, like my man Fred Hampton Jr. did. And kept the money in the house and the family. I agree with you 100%, man.
Okay.
I agree with you, bro. I agree with you. And another thing, you said something about some white cracker up there hijacked the King Day celebration up there on every January 20th. Did you say it? Y'all said that up there?
One of our callers, Joseph. Joseph mentioned it.
Yeah. I think what y'all should do is either give me the information and send it to Bernice King. But they do have a trademark on Dr. King's name and stuff, man. You can't be just using other people's name and making money.
Oh, he's not using it without their permission, Wes. That's what I'm talking about, changing the narrative. He's not using it without their permission.
I'm with you, man. I agree with you, man. It's stuff is sacred, man. I hated that when they was arguing over the Bible and the Nobel Peace Prize, man. And then it went into court, and then they ended up settling it, man. The Nobel Peace Prize and the family Bible and all that, bro. I feel with you on that because I still got my Bible my mama gave me. And it's falling apart. Before I sell it, it ain't worth nothing, but I see your point, man.
Well, that's my whole point. I mean, you know, it don't take much to maintain a Bible. You put it in a glass case or whatever and keep it for posterity, keep it for your children and their families. And, you know, you're going to sell the Bible, the Peace Prize, his underwear, the toothbrush, everything.
That's the boys, man, that got Dexter, man. He got, I think he got a drug problem, man. And he loves them white women. And that dude Dexter, man. He's the main one that's doing all this.
Well, I don't think, he's the youngest. I don't think he's spearhead doing this. He's the youngest. I don't think he's spearheading doing this.
Yeah. Well, it might be him and Martin. Hey, man, do a show with Mr. White, man. I want to talk to him about some stuff in West Virginia. But yeah, I like that, man. I love because we was already here. I want to ask him about the indigenous people that was already over here. Okay, when he talk about the Buffalo Soldiers, it had to be Native Americans, which is us and Blackfoot tribe and the rest of them. That's what I really wanted to see what he talked about. But yeah, man, good show. I love y'all, man, because y'all don't be doing that buffoonery. Don't be playing that stupid music. And y'all make people think. I love stuff that make me think, man. I appreciate that, man. I love y'all, man.
Wes, thank you for your call, bro.
I let somebody talk, man. Peace and blessing, man.
Peace.
Take care now.
Let's go to 267. 267. 267.
Yes.
Yes.
Hey, what's going on, Brother Elliot? This is Brother Oba.
Oh, boy. How you doing, sir?
Oh, man. I'm okay. Sorry that I didn't cut in on the conversation or whatever, but I just, you know, wanted to just give a shout out about the third annual Buy Black Marketplace Free Primes Celebration next week at the Church of the Advocate.
Yep, that's Saturday, December 22nd at the historic Church of the Advocate, 1801 Diamond Street in Philadelphia. It's 12 to 8.
12 p.m.
And the donations is $5. Go ahead.
I just want everybody to come on through next week. You know, we're going to have a vendor's marketplace. Of course, that's one of the most important things about that event is that we have a vendor's marketplace for vendors to sell their goods and services. Also, for people who are preparing for Kwanzaa to buy their Zawadis and Kekas, their corn, their candles, their whole Kwanzaa altar set up. We will have, cultural jewelry, cultural attire, all kinds of decor there for people to go out and buy. It's $5 admission for adults, and it is free for all children. And it's a fundraiser for the African Independence Day NIOT celebration, which will be held coming up on Saturday, August the 3rd, 2019. So we look forward to having everybody come on out. We're going to have entertainment. We're going to have speakers. We're going to have awards presentation, as well as the lighting of a Kanara ceremony. So it's going to be a fun event for the entire family all day next Saturday. Once again, that is Saturday, the 22nd of December from 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Church of the Advocate, 1801 Diamond Street. So for more information, you all can email us at africanindependenceday@gmail.com, African spelled African, independenceday@gmail.com. You can also visit us on our webpage, africanindependenceday.org, African also spelled African. And anybody who's interested in vending, we still have a few vending spots left, and give us a call at 267-521-1544. Once again, it's 267-521-1544.
Yeah, Brother Oba, I do want to congratulate you on not only the marketplace, but the Marcus Garvey Parade at Malcolm X Park. You're right. Consistent in doing what you're doing. And I think that's a key in anything that we're doing towards the community, that we be consistent. I mean, you're out here, you're trying to do things to not only keep these things afloat, but keep the memory of our historic icons and also aspects of our culture in the minds of younger people. So they can see people out here doing positive things, putting these things on the forefront in the community, and it's gonna resonate and register with some minds of youth. We see it's an uphill battle trying to fight against some of these forces that's negative in the community, and that keeps negativity in the minds of some of our young people. But I always want to congratulate you, man, on the work you're doing.
Well, thank you, brother. Elliot and Brother Richard, I'm just humbled. I just do this because I have a love, just a genuine love for African people. As I say on my Facebook page, I live and breathe each day of my life working for the liberation and sovereignty of African people. This is my life. This is how I was raised. This is what I was born to do. And so I just only know how to give. I only know how to give of myself and give everything and leave nothing for myself. This is just who I am. This is what, Almighty God and the ancestors have blessed me to do. And so I just strive to be humble and go about doing it. And I can't thank enough the committee, the African Independence Day Organizing Committee, Urban Shamans Productions, BMI Incorporated, my brothers, Kamur Haru, Sister Mola Luna, and brother Sabora Malik Khan. They are just the greatest people to work with in the world. We all support each other. We all love each other. And we all have a genuine fervor and commitment to African people. We love our people. So we're just going to continue to do this until the wheels fall off. And even when the wheels fall off and sparks are flying underneath that car, we're still going to be moving forward. So, we just are so humble and so gracious. And I just thank you and Brother Richard for always opening up Time for Awakening as a platform for us to, discuss African Independence Day or, Black Love or, even, our Buy Black Marketplace Be Kwanzaa celebration each and every year. We just thank you all for just, showing us the love and just the genuineness that you have for us as African people as well. Without Time for Awakening, without shows, on WRD and other stations, that are really about the community and about African people, then the word wouldn't get out and we wouldn't be able to promote such events like, the pre-Kwanzaa celebration or any of the Kwanzaa celebrations that we'll be having between December 26th and January 1st. So I just thank you, both you and Brother Richard. Thank you.
Brother Oba, Friday, if you want to, you can stop by, give us a call the day before. And just to let everybody know what's going on.
Sounds good. Thank you. Thank you for the invite. I definitely will. We'll have some more information by then. Matter of fact, we can get into some of the people who will be speaking.
Great.
Some of the people who will be performing and, the awards presentations and the ceremony of the lighting of the Kanara to commemorate this 52nd anniversary of the Kwanzaa celebration and holiday. So definitely, I will definitely take you up on that, and I will talk to you on Friday, Brother Ellie.
Good. Talk to you soon, brother.
All right, now, brother. Take care. Peace.
Bye, pal. We got time for two more, Richard.
Go ahead. Let's go.
Let's go. Let's take it. Let's go to 215. 215.
Hey, Brother Elliot. Hey, Brother Richard. How y'all brothers doing tonight?
How are you, sir?
All right.
Praise be to Allah. Yeah, but it's good to hear Brother Oba. I'm going to try to stop down. I think I'm going to try to stop down and support our people at the Church of the Advocate for the African Marketplace. I'm glad you had Brother Oba on. He's a good brother. Like you said, Brother Ellen Richard, we have more brothers, but the love and dedication that brother had for our people, man, boy, we can our people be moving forward. So I definitely support Brother Oba, and I definitely will get down there and support the African Marketplace this weekend. Ellen, you were saying just now about what Brother West was saying about the guy up here, Bernstein, Ty Bernstein, that's his name.
Mm-hmm.
That's the gentleman that has co-opted Dr. King's birthday celebration. But like you was trying to tell West, is that he didn't do it without the King's family permission. You can be sure of that. Believe me, he's doing it because he got the approval and stuff, And see, when you look at the King family and stuff, and I love Dr. King, I love Miss King, because I met Miss King back at our family reunion in Atlanta, Georgia, back in the summer of 99. But some of those children of his, and I, like you said, Ellen, I agree, I think Dexter, believe it or not, he might be the most conscious of them. His late sister, she wasn't the most conscious, and Bernie's wishy-washy on things. I think Dexter and Martin, where his head is at. So I think that Dexter might be the most conscious of the remaining King children. But see, they show, and like you said, Elliot, to Brother West, you got the sister, Dr. King's biological sister, that negress, she run around supporting Trump and Reagan and Bush and all them other devils. So you know where her sick head is at and stuff. And, when Mrs. King made transition back in 2006, that family, like I said, they, here you got Harry Belafonte and Dick Gregory, all these righteous brothers that supported the King family through their most toughest times financially and everything. They weren't even invited to the funeral of Miss King. But yet you had a devil like George Bush, the late president, who just died a few weeks ago. They had this devil at the King funeral, and it's the same individual, Elliot and Richard, as you well know, that started the first Iraq war, where he was dropping bombs on innocent Iraqi men, women, and children, killing them by the thousands and stuff. And he did it. Remember that first Iraq war, Ellen, which he did it right on Dr. King's birthday, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't no accident. He did that on purpose. And yet you had that handkerchief of King family inviting that devil to be at Miss King's funeral, but yet Harry Belafonte and Dick Gregory, people like that, they wasn't allowed to come. I mean, that was insulting. And so, but we got to stop, you know, letting Negroes get away with stuff like that, disrespect our people like they had an open enemy at your relatives, like you was telling West about the government and stuff. Like you said, why would you want to sell your family's heirlooms to this devil when he's the one that killed your father? You know what I mean? So, I mean, we got to stop that, because like you said, I agree with you, Elliot, and I'm like just saying it to be saying it, because if I disagree with you, Elliot, I would man up to tell you I disagree with you, Elliot, but you're right about that. We got to stop this. You know, everything has a price, because that's the problem with us. We take them too many of them European mentality. Everything has a price. Damn it, ain't something sacred to black people anymore? I mean, we the only people that I know on the face of this earth, and correct me if I'm wrong, that our funeral home is not even sacred no more. That would be something that we could say that was black owned. Now white folks, Koreans, every damn body else, they behind the scenes pulling the strings at our funeral homes now. I mean, damn, is anything sacred anymore? You know, you got to ask yourself that sometimes, man. You know, I mean, why would you just want to sell have all things to the government that King had? Like I said, we got enough black. Like I said, that's what John Lewis is supposed to be down there for. He's supposed to be down in Atlanta. He's supposed to have been a protege of Dr. King. Why wasn't he down there fighting to preserve? He got the money and the wherewithal. Why wasn't he fighting for the King family to make sure that house stays in black people's possession, or the King family's possession, or whatever, black people's possession? What the hell is he doing? That's why I say he's useless. That's why, like I told you the other week, I agree with Brother Jay 100%. It's time for John Lewis to go. Not that I don't, you know, like I said, not that I, you know, don't respect what he has did over the years, but he's ineffective. He's sitting there taking up space where it could be a young progressive sister brother in that office advocating for, because I think if you had a young progressive black man or woman, Ellen Richard, in that seat in Georgia, I think the King's home, the King family home, would still be in the possession of black people. That's the way I feel. But John Lewis is so ineffective at this point, Richard and Elliot. He's just sitting there taking up space, man. Y'all, he's doing at this point in his life is collecting a paycheck. I hate to reduce it on those terms, but that's what he's doing. He's useless. He's not doing a damn thing for black people in Georgia or black people anywhere else for that matter. It's that simple. It's time for him to go. But he's so selfish, he just want to hang on to that seat so he can say he in power or he got this seat. But what the hell is you doing for your people? But all he's doing is being a in the way and being a pawn for white racism and for white domination, while people intend to catch hell, and while he's sitting in that seat doing nothing, doing absolutely nothing, by sitting up with Nancy Pelosi at these conferences and meetings, doing nothing getting done for black people. That's the bottom line, you know. So, I mean, it's just a sad commentary where we have came now, where things can't even stay in the possession of black people. Something as sacred as that, like you said, it may sound foolhardy, but you're right. Some of that family's so skewed up, like you said, they could find a toothbrush that Dr. King used back in 1954. They would sell that to the white man. You know, it's anything sacred anymore, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you just ask yourself, you know, hey. So I don't know. I just get frustrated, and I just throw up my hands sometimes, like everybody else, and say, you know, what the hell is going on here, and stuff, man? What is going on here? And last point, like I say, right here in Philadelphia, like I say, you got this Todd Bernstein, and his brother West, if you're still listening, that's his name. Like I say, he got these black children. Every January of Dr. King's birthday, had these black children out there cleaning streets, sweeping down streets, cleaning out alleyways, painting sidewalks, cleaning out gymnasiums and restrooms, and all he give them is a damn T-shirt. Them black children don't need no damn, they need a damn some money. Give these black kids a nice stipend. Don't give them this no sandwich and a T-shirt and stuff. Give these kids some money so they can put in their bank account and stuff, man. Here you as the head of this Dr. King celebration every week, making millions of dollars, getting a six figure. You giving our black children some damn sandwich and a T-shirt, man. Hell with that. Give these black children some money where they could put it in the bank, where they could save some money and stuff, where they could build them a little savings and stuff like that. You wouldn't treat no white children like that. But see, again, Elliot and Richard, I don't just blame that devil. I blame our misleadership, because these Negroes that's in city council and state government, they let this white Jew get away with this stuff every year. They don't do nothing, so that's why he continued to does it and stuff. You know, if he had strong black leadership, that stuff wouldn't be going on in this city. But unfortunately, we have what we have, and we keep voting for them same kind of individuals. That's why we keep getting what we getting. So that's how they say that in their mouth, okay?
Thank you for your call, Joe.
Thanks, Brother Elliot. Thanks, Brother Richard.
Peace. All right, now.
Richard, we got 4-5 minutes left, and we got the guy moved back into the cleanup spot, so we'll see if he can drive the runs in these last few minutes. Let's see if he can drive the runs in, or he's going to strike out. Let's go to 646.
Well, listen, first I got to just say, Little Joe, be nice when you talk about one of the finest Negroes the civil rights movement has ever produced. John Lewis, there's not a better Negro in the world who's ever been slapped upside his head and then came back buck dancing, shuffling, and doing all the necessary things to make the white man happy. Stand up for Don Lewis, Little Joe. But listen, why do we expect anything different from the King children? I mean, what is really expected of them? Honestly, I don't really honestly get too upset when they do things, because it's at the point now that it's expected of them. Now, I'm no fan of Harry Belafonte. I don't have no love for no white man that marry a Yoruba woman. He just can't get no love and no respect for me. That's just my life position. But the thing is, how could you have such great admiration for the King family when they go out there and disrespect the man who put food and shelter in their lives? When you're talking about Mr. Belafonte or Harry or whatever the hell you want to call it, and others that did the necessary thing to keep them afloat when Dr. King was murdered. So the bottom line is, I think in all honesty, they haven't shown anything at all in regards to they have black people in the above position over white folks. Every time I've observed them, they always trying to get closer to the sky daddy or to the white man. So, you know, basically, they just screwed up. You know what I mean? Now, I think they could have done more with the intellectual properties of their father, but you know what I mean? Hey, they're doing what they got to do. Now, I'm interested in to see how much money they got for the house. Did they say how much money they got for it?
Yeah, it says $1.9 million, but neither one of them is confirming it. But from sources.
That ain't no real money considering.
Exactly.
You know, considering what that property is really worth if it was handled right. But, hey, listen, Elliot, we are at a point in this country now, in all truthfulness, where we as a people don't even have a position here. Or we act as though we don't have a position here. You know, me and this woman got into a big, big argument today when she was trying to push upon me Kamala Harris as becoming the first female president in the United States. Lord have mercy. Now, you know, the woman was an elder, so I had to play a little nice with her because I just don't believe in going off too much. But I asked her one simple question. What is your feeling about adultery? Oh, I don't support adultery. None whatsoever. Well, I said, ma'am, you're asking this woman who you envision being the head of the United States, the moral compass of the United States, and you upset about the dirtbag that's in office. And there it is, this woman that you're talking about is a blatant whore. What are you talking about, sir? What are you talking about? What are you talking? I said, miss, have you done any research on this woman? Have you read anything about this woman in regards to her immoral behavior with the mayor of San Francisco, Willie Brown, when he was married to a beautiful black woman? What are you talking about? I said, hold on one second, miss. I'm gonna help you out right quick because I see you don't know. Here, so I Googled up the story about Willie Brown and her having an affair and all the shenanigans that went on in San Francisco. You know what the woman told me? That ain't got nothing to do with anything. That ain't got nothing to do with anything. She's like Barack Obama. She'll lead the country in a better place. I said to her, miss, may the ancestors bless you and may you have a beautiful day. And I shook my head and I walked away from her and I just said, this is what the Negro is going to be doing when it comes down to this woman. Now, mind you, I told her, look, I'm not even talking about the fact that she got a white husband. So how do you think that's going to look at the landscape around America with the fans that support Donald Trump? Do you think they ain't going to come out and go to block that type of nonsense? Now, they tolerated Michelle Obama and Barack because those, as they would say, two Negroes. But do you think they're going to put jungle fever at the face of America? Now, I don't think a lot of people be talking about what's going on over there in England and how people are upset about Prince Harry and Markle and their little marriage. You know what I mean? People ain't really been talking about that. But when you go on the web, you see that, you know, the England people got a little issue with it. Maybe Paul will talk about it one day if you call in. But the bottom line is this. Nobody does any research on these people that are pushed on us, like Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Beto, and the rest of them. Why is it now that they always got to give the mulatto to try and save the nation? But well, any other time, they don't want to treat us in a fair and precise and kind way, to whereas we are felt to be a part of this society. You know what I mean? Nobody realized, and unfortunately, we don't even realize the power that we honestly have in the vote. That's the crazy thing.
Well, before I let you go, Jane, let me tell you, she was right in one thing. She said that, she said that Kamala Harris would be just like Barack Obama. She's right.
Of course.
And Cory Booker, all of them, they would be just like Barack Obama.
Okay, now let me ask you this. Do you think that's what we need?
Oh, come on, man, you know better than that.
Okay, so the point of the matter is, why are we going to place ourselves in a position to confuse our people again when we're supposed to be trying to move forward to sovereignty? When we're supposed to be waking up? Why would you?
Well,
it's like going from the bush to bush. And then, you know, if the wing nut didn't stop it, then would it have probably been Jeb Bush? You know what I mean? At what point in time is the country going to move forward in a direction that's going to make it a better country instead of the recycled country of these individuals that are not taking it nowhere? Because you and I both know, honestly, I believe, that by the time these next 2 years are up, that this country is going to be far worse than it's ever been in regards to the debt crises and every other type of crisis going on in this country, because they're going to basically go all out on this clown in office. And the erratic type individual that he is, he's going to cause a lot of problems that we ain't never seen before, because he's not going to function on the level that he needs to function and all of the other factions in society is going to be able to come in and manipulate and do things that's just going to cause total havoc. But it seems to me nobody wants to realize that this is what could happen. But mind you this, and think about this. They talk about what Russia did to the election. What do you think other people are going to do to the country knowing that they got a invulnerable nut job in the House that could be manipulated, and you got people surrounding them that don't even really have a clear understanding of governance?
Well, I'll tell you what, let's continue it on Friday.
And you got to show up to work though on Friday. What happened? I know the daddy wore Richard out, so I know that's why he been quiet all night tonight, because he tried to conserve his strength and go back to the daddy tomorrow. Now, your case, Elliot, I don't know what to say about you. You just didn't show up to work. I don't know if you had a hot date. I don't know if you had a good poker party going. I don't know what it was, but we always have a valid excuse for Brother Richard. Right, Brother Richard?
We'll talk to you soon.
Have a good one, brother. Enjoy the night.
Right. Take care.
All right.
Before we wind things up, I want to go over that lineup Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with Brother Ushi. Always interesting dialogue and conversation on African Perspectives. Catch it Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Later that evening from 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. And from 8 to 9, Let's Buy Black365.com with Sister Nataki and Brother Talib. On Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. On Wednesday, Revive is back with Sister POC from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. On Thursday, from 7 to 8, the Joy and Joy Hour, a black relationship show. And, brothers and sisters out there, call Joy and Troy and let them know about black relationships from a married couple of 18 years, I think, Richard.
Oh,
getting
yeah.
on there, sharing things in relation to relationships. It was a change of pace there. I listened to the past few shows, but it's kind of interesting. Joy and Troy on Thursdays from 7 to 8 on Time for an Awakening, and then Time for Awakening is back on Friday from 8 to 10. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take. Oh,
friend. Soon it will be their chance to try and save the world. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. To save the children. To save the children.